Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with President Trump campaign's rally in Miami on President's Day, at which he fired up Latino voters with his attacks on Venezuela's Maduro, conflating Maduro's disastrous impoverishment of an oil-rich country with what he is trying to portray as the socialist menace here at home, advocated by Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Senator Bernie Sanders. Michael Shifter, President for Policy and Director of the Andean Program at the Inter-American Dialogue, joins us to discuss Trump's Miami visit aimed at stoking fears of socialism to win elections and how the Democrats have been caught flat-footed in the key 2020 re-election state of Florida. We will assess how much the chaos in Venezuela is helping Trump in the absence of a narrative from the Democrats on how best to deal with Maduro, who is blocking aid shipments to the country while threats of military intervention by Trump only served to help Maduro cling to power. With Latinos largely supporting Democrats due to Trump's border policy and racist remarks against Mexicans, could events in Venezuela help Republicans make inroads with Latino voters? And what strategies could the divided Democrats adopt in Florida to avoid being pegged as the party who would bring you an American version of Cuba and Venezuela? Then, with Senator Bernie Sanders' announcement today he's running for president in 2020, we will speak with Eric Levitz, who writes for New York Magazine's Daily Intelligencer and has covered Senator Bernie Sanders extensively. He joins us to discuss Sanders' strengths, having aroused a youthful populist vote on the American left, and whether the division between centrist Democrats and progressives that WikiLeaks and the Russians exploited in 2016 will be inflamed in the 2020 primaries among Democratic hopefuls trying to get noticed in a crowded field. Then, finally, we'll investigate the almost daily scandals erupting in the Catholic Church with revelations about a secret Vatican department's procedures to deal with children fathered by priests, the defrocking of a prominent American cardinal, and a homosexual network within the church's hierarchy. Kenneth Briggs, who writes for the National Catholic Reporter and is a former religion editor at the New York Times, joins us to assess how the Pope can deal with these longstanding and mounting problems in his upcoming Sex Abuse Prevention Summit. And before we begin today's program, I want to thank listeners like you who are helping us build a new home online at backgroundbriefing.org. We encourage you to bookmark our new website and join the community of listeners we are building nationwide with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep us independent and free from corporate sponsors so that we can continue to provide breaking news analysis from the most knowledgeable guests we can find as we build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now is Michael Shifter, who is President for Policy and Director of the Andean Program at the Inter-American Dialogue and is the co-editor, along with Jorge Dominguez, of Constructing Democratic Governance in Latin America. He also writes and comments widely on U.S.-Latin American relations and hemispheric affairs and has regularly testified before Congress about U.S. policy towards Latin America. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Shifter.
Thank you very much. Appreciate the invitation.
Well, thank you, Michael. And what did you make of Donald Trump's attempts to conflate the chaos in Venezuela with the specter of the menace of socialism in his State of the Union? He said basically, you know, socialism is trying to take over America, and we're never going to have let the left, and of course the cameras cut to Bernie Sanders, take away our freedoms. So he started out with that, but then on President's Day in Miami, he really did seem to rouse up an audience there of a lot of supporters of Venezuela, or certainly not the president of Venezuela. And the impression I got was that he may be successful in this key swing state of peeling off some Latino votes, you know, after having alienated so many Latino voters with his racist remarks about Mexicans and his border policy. So how do you think this is shaping up domestically? And then, of course, we'll talk about what's happening in Venezuela.
Well, it's for those of us who follow Latin America, it's not unusual for there to be a strong dosis of domestic politics in the U.S. approach towards the region. We see that on drugs, migration, and trade, everything else. So this is also domestic politics. And this was Trump's speech yesterday on President's Day was like a campaign rally. And they played the same music as they play at the campaign rallies, and he had a crowd. It was a adoring crowd. He's clearly trying to use this for his campaign to say that if the socialist, meaning the Democrat, the socialist part of the Democratic Party, gains ground and prevails in 2020, we're going to end up like Venezuela, which is a disaster. And of course, that's completely, I think, wrong and inaccurate. But of course, this is politics, and Trump is trying to take advantage of Venezuela's horror and disaster, which it is, for his own political agenda in the United States. Now, the crowd, I just think, just to make one clarification, the crowd was largely Cuban American and Venezuelans community. Which is about 150,000 or so in Miami. And, of course, the Cubans are about 1 million. And this is the hardcore, anti-Castro crowd that are in solidarity with the Venezuelan diaspora in their opposition to Maduro. I do not believe that if he wants to gain the Latino vote more widely, most of the Latinos in this country are Mexican. Background, I don't think this will make a dent in that whatsoever. This is very much a very special situation, a particular case, and he may gain some ground with Cuban and raise some money with the Cuban Americans and the Venezuelans living in the U.S. who are very enthusiastic about Trump taking a much harder line than Obama did. And, he'll raise money and he'll get some support. May make a difference in Florida. Maybe modest difference, but overall, it's not going to bring the Latinos around to his side.
But do the Democrats have a counter narrative, both in Florida and in the broader issue of how to deal with Maduro?
Well, their narrative right now is to say that this is not socialism; that this is somebody who is largely corrupt, criminal. State, this is not a question of left and right. In other words, their comeback is to say this is not an ideological question. To frame it that way is ridiculous. This is an incompetent government that has presided over the complete destruction of the country, and it's not because has nothing to do with what we hear Bernie Sanders and Alejandro Ocasio-Cortez saying, and this is completely ridiculous to make this kind of comparison. That is their comeback. Of course, they don't want to, Trump is in general on the right side of this issue because Maduro has really caused tremendous suffering and an unprecedented refugee crisis that we've never seen in the Western Hemisphere before. But clearly the Democrats want to distance themselves from this kind of tactic and this kind of rhetoric, which is very aggressive and also threatening the generals who are still with Maduro and giving them ultimatums, which they have done. And I mean, Trump was very blunt and direct in his remarks and his speech, saying the generals better fold and turn from Maduro to the interim president Guaido. And I personally think that's not going to work, and I think it's counterproductive. And I don't think the Democrats at all support that approach. So there is some distance there, but certainly the Democrats are not going to come around and support or be sympathetic with Maduro. He's not a very sympathetic figure.
And again, I'm speaking with Michael Shifter, who is president for policy and director of the Andean Program at the Inter-American Dialogue and co-editor, along with Jorge Dominguez, of Constructing Democratic Governance in Latin America. He also writes and comments widely on U.S.-Latin American relations and hemispheric affairs and has regularly testified before Congress about U.S. policy towards Latin America. But do you think, I mean, I mentioned in the opening, Michael, that Trump's remarks, which he makes on regular occasions, where he alludes to a military intervention being on the table, that's just incredibly counterproductive. From what I understand, it really does help Maduro cling to power. But yeah. Their policies, which seem to be led by Senator Marco Rubio, who again is from Florida and is out of that anti-Castro community. He seems to be the point man on it. And I don't know, do they have any strategy beyond this attempt at trying to get food in through the Colombian side, which the Venezuelan military is blocking?
Well, the strategy is very much in coordination with the Venezuelan opposition. The strategy is to try to peel off the senior military officials from Maduro to Guaido. And the humanitarian aid effort that will take place on the 23rd on Saturday is very much in line with this. I mean, they're betting that the military will not be able to deny the entry of aid, and they won't do it because they know that the people are suffering. And if they do, it would reflect very badly on the military. And so they're putting them in a tough spot. That's what the political strategy is. That's what the calculation is. I'm not sure whether that's going to happen. I think we really don't know how the military are going to respond. There may be some, violence. It's clearly a provocation, to the armed forces of Venezuela. But that's the plan. That's the betting. And it's important to note that I think from the administration's point of view, people like Rubio or John Bolton and others, I think really believe that this would already that Maduro would have already collapsed. This happened on January 23rd, and now we're, February 19th. And so time has gone by, and this is not, they underestimated the resilience of Maduro and the resistance of the senior military officials to stick with him. There are reports of defections and some cracks in the armed forces for sure, but it's so far from what one can tell from the outside, they're kind of sticking with him, which really, challenges the whole rationale behind the policy. And I'm not sure there's a plan B. If this continues for another couple of months, the sanctions that are being applied in Venezuela, meaning cutting off all the oil, purchases of Venezuelan oil, which is the only thing Venezuela makes, is having a devastating impact on the humanitarian situation. Trump administration believed that doing that, the military would say, "Well, this is over. Let's just give in and because it's not sustainable. If they cut off our oil exports, then we're in big trouble." But of course, that hasn't happened. And if it continues for a long time, and Maduro holds on some way, the effects of that sanctions that are being applied by the United States could be absolutely devastating, making an already terrible situation even worse, if that's possible, and will contribute to the exodus of even more Venezuelans leaving their country, and will also pose some real problems for the opposition, and of course, will staying together, because people will say, "Well, your expectation was this would be over quickly, and look, it's dragging on," and of course, it will be very negative for the United States as well, which is basically believe that this would all happen in a short period of time and doesn't really have a plan B if this doesn't work. So I don't think, and the use of military intervention and the talk about it, all options on the table, is not very helpful. I do agree with you completely that it's counterproductive, and it could just lead the military to become even stronger, more loyal to Maduro. And it has another effect, which I want to emphasize, which is that the Latin American governments that are currently joining the Trump administration and applying pressure to Maduro are extremely uneasy and, in fact, reject completely any possibility of a military intervention. So to the extent the administration emphasizes that point, the risk is that they will lose the Latin American support that has been with them so far on pressuring Maduro. The Latin American governments do not support that. They don't believe in that, and they don't believe it's very helpful.
But isn't it a rather odd position for these democratic governments in Central and South America, and here in the United States, for that matter, to be urging a military coup? I mean, isn't that what the sad history of our intervention in this hemisphere has been over the last several decades?
Well, I'm not sure they're advocating it, too. I mean, they're talking about foreign intervention. I mean, you have to move from the situation that currently exists, which is that having a illegitimate president who's not recognized by more than 60 countries, including Canada and including the major powers in Western Europe, to a transition situation. So I'm not sure that the coup is the way to go, but clearly there needs to be some sort of transition. I think my own view is that I think there should be a negotiation with the armed forces to give them some protection and some guarantees, and that this takes a while to work out. And this may have been a little more precipitous, but that wouldn't be a coup. It would be a worked out transition, which we've seen in other countries in the world. So I think, the terrible scenario would be if, we're calling for a coup and the military could come in, and it could be a hard coup, and the repression can get even worse and the crackdown even worse. And so I think that's something that absolutely we should, is unacceptable and has a long history in Latin America, as we know.
Right. But at the end of the day, it isn't our policy or the Trump administration's policy to put added pressure on the people by increasing their deprivation in order to pressure the military to intervene and get rid of Maduro? So, you can call it a coup, you can call it an intervention.
It's more withdrawing support from Maduro.
Right.
Maduro could just see that he's, that he can't hold on because he's lost the main pillar of his government, which is the armed forces, and then he resigns, and then he goes into exile, he goes to Cuba or wherever he goes. And then Guaido, who is recognized, presides over a transition government and calls for elections in 30 days or 60 days. And so, and the military switches from Maduro to Guaido. Now, that's the scenario that a lot of people are, hoping will happen. So far, it hasn't. I'm not sure it will. I have some doubts, but there's a lot of confidence among the administration officials and even, in the opposition that this is the scenario that's going to play out.
Right. But in the meantime, the price that's being paid is the people suffer more because of the sanctions. And the question is, can the aid get to them? And I guess putting pressure on Maduro as the person who's adding to the starvation and deprivation of the people, that is also the strategy.
Right. I don't think there's any possibility that this aid is really going to make a dent in the humanitarian crisis. In Venezuela, this is all kind of political theater and symbols and trying to send messages and trying to change behavior. But I don't think this is a serious effort to alleviate the crisis. That will require a change, a political change at some point, because clearly Maduro has presided over the dramatic deterioration in the country and his policies have caused a lot of this poverty and suffering and people leaving the country. And so there needs to be a change. He's made a few attempts to try to do it, but none of them have really changing his policies, but they haven't worked and have been done with a lot of, with a lot of support. And so everything has failed. And so I think the humanitarian crisis will only begin to be seriously addressed when there is a different government. It could be, it could be a Chavista government. In other words, it could be somebody else, but not Maduro. Mm-hmm. And so that's also a scenario. In other words, Maduro would leave, but they get somebody who is more competent and more able to preside over economic policy. That's not something that's going to be acceptable to the opposition, but that's
well. But you said that they were going to have elections, so that's the plan. But
that's what they want. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. Yeah, well, Michael, we've run out of time, but I appreciate your joining us.
Sure, my pleasure. Thank you very much.
And again, I've been speaking with Michael Shifter, who is President for Policy and Director of the Andean Program at the Inter-American Dialogue and is co-editor, along with Jorge Dominguez, of Constructing Democratic Governments in Latin America. He also writes and comments widely on U.S.-Latin American relations and hemispheric affairs and has regularly testified before Congress about U.S. policy towards Latin America. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into Bernie Sanders' announcement today that he's running for president in 2020.
Una potra la sana, caballo viejo se encuentra, el pecho se le desgrana y no le hace caso a faceta, y no le obedece a freno ni lo paran pasas riendas.
As I went walking that ribbon of highway, I saw above me that endless skyway. I saw below me that golden valley. This land was made for you and me.
This land is your land.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Eric Levitz, who writes for New York Magazine's Daily Intelligencer, where his latest article is Meet the New Bernie Campaign, Same as the Old Bernie Campaign. Welcome to Background Briefing, Eric Levitz.
Thanks for having me.
And, of course, Bernie Sanders announced he's running again for the presidency in 2020. And in terms of the title of your article, Eric, of course, running against Donald Trump would be different from running against Hillary Clinton. I mean, to some extent, didn't Bernie Sanders have his one hand tied behind his back running against Hillary?
Well, yes and no. I mean, before Bernie has the chance to go up against Trump, he's got to defeat this Democratic primary field, which currently consists of, I think, maybe a dozen declared candidates and seems to be growing. And it's a pretty talented field of distinguished progressive senators, and a couple of governors, I believe, might eventually get involved. But so I think on the one hand, it is the case that in 2016, the Democratic establishment was heavily unified behind Hillary Clinton, to the point where I don't think that when Bernie Sanders launched his 2016 campaign, he had any intention of winning the nomination. I don't think he considered that a serious possibility. And I don't think, honestly, in retrospect, he ever really had a chance because of how strong Clinton's infrastructure was, particularly with African-American institutions and community groups throughout the South. So in that respect, his prospects might be better this time. On the other hand, during that election, he was able to harness the dissatisfaction, the anyone but Hillary vote, sort of just anybody who was, for whatever reason, did not take too kindly or view Clinton too sympathetically for a variety of different potential reasons. Sanders was able to effectively leverage that and be the one alternative to this establishment candidate. This time there's going to be a variety of people who have some sort of narrative that paints them as outsiders or anti-establishment or progressive alternatives. And so he's going to have his work cut out for him in terms of distinguishing himself from those candidates and maintaining the loyalty and enthusiasm of his activist base.
But has that cleavage that emerged, and it was obviously exacerbated by WikiLeaks and Russian military intelligence dumping the DNC contents on the eve of the Democratic Convention, to drive a wedge between the centrist or so-called corporate Democrats and the more progressive wing that Bernie represents, hasn't that cleavage actually become now front and center?
You know, I don't know. I think that Sanders is going to try to make that cleavage more salient. If you look at polling right now, the Democratic primary electorate is a very specific thing. And Democratic primary voters, I think a poll today that the overwhelming majority of Bernie Sanders supporters have very positive feelings about Kamala Harris. And the overwhelming majority of Kamala Harris supporters have positive feelings about Bernie Sanders. The Democratic primary electorate, there are ideological factions and the Democratic donor class and activist base, there are sharp divisions over policy between a certain segment of donors and the sort of small dollar army that Sanders has. But in terms of rank and file voters, the median Democratic primary voter is not very ideological. There's been some polling that's shown that people who name Bernie Sanders as their top choice for the nominee put Biden behind him, and then Beto O'Rourke third, and then Elizabeth Warren fourth. So they're not actually prioritizing policy. So anyhow, there's a potential for this ideological cleavage to be the terrain that the debate is centered on. But Sanders is going to have to do some work to make that happen because it's not automatic.
But my sense is that that's where the problem lies, is it not? You've got such a big field, and just by nature, even if they try to be polite amongst each other, and once you get past 20 or so, I think they're going to have to split the debates into two separate stages with 10 candidates on one and 10 on another on consecutive nights. So it's already feels a little unwieldy. But my understanding of the way these things work out is that eventually in the heat of the battle, it's just impossible for them all to be nice. So maybe they'll start attacking each other. And frankly, in the age of Trump, that doesn't seem like a luxury any of us can afford.
Yeah, I do think that at some point, conflict is going to be inevitable. You know, you've got to take figures like Kamala Harris and Cory Booker, who are going to be competing pretty intensely for especially the African-American vote. And you've got one, you know, as Booker has liabilities in with progressives on things like financial reform and charter schools. But he's actually been pretty aggressive on criminal justice reform, where Harris is a career prosecutor who has in her record a lot of things that progressives sort of bristle at, such as prosecuting the parents of truant children and such. It is hard to imagine that when they're competing in the South Carolina primary, that Booker is going to refrain from attacking her on her vulnerabilities and vice versa. And similarly, in places like New Hampshire or Iowa, places of potential strength for both Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, I'm not sure exactly how they're going to handle it, but it seems like they're going to have to put forward, you know, some argument for why a certain kind of progressive voter should prefer one of them over the other. So it will be interesting to see how that shakes out.
And again, I'm speaking with Eric Levitz, who writes for New York Magazine's Daily Intelligencer, where his latest article is Meet the New Bernie Campaign, Same as the Old Bernie Campaign. But what was interesting, I thought, about the 2016 primaries, Eric Levitz, was that, you know, the reality TV star knocked everybody off the island on the Republican side with language and behavior that simply has never been seen before in politics. And I think that's why he was successful, because he wasn't a politician. He went to great lengths to say that he wasn't a politician. And I think an awful number of people in this country are thoroughly fed up and alienated from politicians and from politics. And that played well for Trump. But what he was always careful to do, and he trashed Hillary Clinton, and he, as you know, he still trashes her, but he didn't trash Bernie. He knew that a lot of Bernie voters voted for him. So that would seem to me to be where Bernie Sanders' strength lies, in the fact that he can cross over between, you know, in other words, he's an authentic populist. Trump was a faux populist. So if an authentic populist can reach the Trump voters with a real message, that would seem to be a winning strategy.
Yeah, well, I think that's the argument that the Sanders campaign is going to make, especially to counter this sort of knee-jerk reaction that a lot of pundits and such have, you know, that, oh, he's a democratic socialist, he's extreme, therefore he's not electable, you know. And I do think that there is an argument there. Sanders, it's a liability to some respect in the Democratic primary because he doesn't have as much experience and ties with the Black community and the Latino community. But Sanders has managed to win elections as a Democratic socialist in a predominantly white rural state. And there are distinctions between the Vermont electorate and the Midwest Rust Belt electorate, but there's also a lot of overlap. We're talking about a lot of non-college educated white people, working class people who live in not terribly dense areas and are also typically, this particular slice of them, mostly secular, not terribly evangelical. This is the swing vote that Trump won in 2016, secular working class whites. And this is a constituency that Sanders has been speaking to and winning in Vermont for several decades. And so I think that combined with his consistent stance on trade, in globalization and his fluency in, you know, this very clear class-centered message, I think gives credibility to the argument that he would actually be exceptionally effective in these particular Midwest Rust Belt states that cost Hillary the election.
Well, I was amused when Bernie first started to run, when he was doing interviews with some of the big network political talk shows. Many of the anchors basically said, are you a democratic socialist? And he said, yes. And they more or less said, well, you can't run. You'll never win. You have to renounce that. I mean, they didn't say that specifically, but that was the kind of tone and he stuck by it. And I think people actually respect him for that. And, of course, now the socialism or the S word Trump is using, and he's trying to conflate Americans like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Senator Sanders with the socialism of Venezuela. And, of course, just prior to you in today's program, we were talking about that, the rally down in Florida on President's Day down in Miami, where Trump basically showed the contours of his campaign. One, he's going to win over Latinos by bashing what's going on in Venezuela, and two, he's trying to tar the Democratic Party with that brush of socialism. But the real sense, though, is that semantics are important, and I don't understand why he calls himself a democratic socialist, not a social democrat. There's nothing controversial about being a social democrat. Almost all of the West European governments for decades were run by social democrats in Italy, France, Germany, Sweden, etc. So what is the difference between a social democrat and a democratic socialist?
Yeah, I think this is a really good question. It's something that I've had my own quibbles about. You know, normally the left's project rhetorically is to redefine terms in the opposite direction. So a lot of left-wing Sanders supporters will call Barack Obama a neoliberal or a Rockefeller Republican instead of a progressive, because they're trying to partially grade U.S. politics on the same ideological scale as the rest of the world, as Western Europe. So like for a Western European politician, Obama's positions would put him on the center right. And so we should call him center right. And this is normally how the left operates. And yet in because of Sanders and related movements, they're doing the opposite with socialism, where they're taking Sanders' policy program. Nothing in there is about collectivizing the means of production or the commanding heights of the economy. It's about universal health care, free public college. It's welfare liberalism. It's social democracy. So it is an odd tactic. I do think that the intention behind it for institutions like the Democratic Socialists of America, the DSA, is essentially to take the popularity of these universal welfare programs, these social democratic programs, and try to increase the popularity, favorability, and public comfort with socialism by associating it with these programs that are already pretty popular, these ideas that are pretty popular. So that's part of the logic. The other part of it is this idea that it's important to the democratic socialists largely believe that their vision of socialism cannot be achieved until we first get to social democracy. And so for now, their goals are identical with social democrats, but that fundamentally social democracy is unstable because eventually capital rebels. And if you leave them the power to withhold private investment and throw your economy into recession, essentially to do a capital strike, then you're always going to be vulnerable. And so basically they want to build a commitment as early as possible and as strong as possible to, we're going to institute social democracy, and then when capitalists start to mess with it, we're going to go all the way to socialism. So that's their logic.
Right. But the real argument to me would be that there is no distinction. I mean, social democracy is real democracy. If you look at the countries that I mentioned that have always had social democratic governments for decades, like Italy, France, and Germany, and Scandinavia, etc., and Australia, and New Zealand, and even Israel in the early days, the whole compact between the voter and the government is very simple. You vote for people who are stewards of your tax money and provide you with government services in return. And it's a very simple formula. And the American people are totally alienated from that simple formula because they're encouraged to vote for all kinds of extraneous reasons like guns and abortion. And I think if somebody made that simple case that is the real job of a democracy, for the people to choose sober, sensible, and honest stewards of their tax money in order to provide them with the social services that tax money should provide in the most efficient way.
Yeah, I think that's a sound argument. I think that we see, you know, even in the United States, it is absolutely true that a lot of extraneous culture war issues are where elections get fought and decided sometimes. But you nevertheless still see that defending the little bits of social democracy that we've got, Medicare and Social Security, is perennially a core part of Democratic presidential campaigns and is forever, to the Republicans' frustration, impossible for them to really mess with. They have not been able to, despite many efforts, to roll back Social Security or Medicare. And in fact, they weren't even able to roll back the most unpopular, vulnerable, and newest little branch of our welfare state, Obamacare. They couldn't even get the votes to do that, which goes to show the innate popularity of social democratic welfare programs and the degree to which these programs even get more popular once they're enacted and create constituencies once they're enacted. Yeah, so I think that's something for the Democrats and progressives to keep in mind.
Well, there's no question in my mind that there is this alienation, and I think it's what helped elect Trump. And I'm not sure how to heal it. And one of the things that they have in Australia, of course, is compulsory voting, which to some extent does fix the problem, because even politicians on the right have got to preserve the social safety net because 90% of the people vote, and they vote for things that they like. But in this country, I think the reason why what little we have in terms of a social safety net is under complete and relentless assault by the Republicans is that the real issue in this country is a battle between what's left of our democracy and the power of the incipient plutocracy that, because of Citizens United, more and more is running our government, and our legislators have been turned into telemarketers who dial for dollars all day. And again, I think if Bernie Sanders were able to cut to the chase here and get to the heart of what's wrong, I mean, I know he talks about millionaires and billionaires. Maybe that refrain can be sharpened up a little bit. But he announced it today and talked about Trump in terms that I think are very understandable and quite accurate, that he's a racist, a homophobe, a xenophobe, etc. But the cautionary note would be, I think, Hillary Clinton ran against Trump, and look where that got her.
Yeah, I think that Sanders is going to run against plutocracy, whether or not he uses that specific term. That is the core focus of his career and, I think, of most of his announcement materials today. And I do think that's going to be his target, and I think it is the correct target. I think that the problem is bigger than Citizens United and bigger than campaign contributions. I think that sometimes the left can overemphasize the role that direct campaign contributions play, which, even though they are important, just having discrepancies of wealth as large as our countries do allows great wealth to work its way into politics by all sorts of means, by the ownership of major media outlets, by the funding of think tanks and university chairs and various propaganda outfits, and through things like the ALEC, the Legislative Council that feeds legislative language to state houses all across the country. And then to stuff that's indirectly related, but the collapse of local journalism, which really makes it much easier for well-heeled interests to dictate their will to local governments, local and state governments. So we're in a lot of trouble, and it's coming from a lot of different directions. But the recent uptick in left-wing organizing that is both reflected by the Sanders 2016 campaign and a product of it, along with the recent polling data on the attitudes of millennials, suggests that there is, you know, some hope for a progressive movement that can counter the forces of class war from the 1%.
Well, just in closing, in a brief minute, if we can, Eric, you've been writing a lot about identifying some of the deeper historical currents taking place in our polish. And you've written about how there seems to be something of a divorce taking place between business elites and social conservatives, which Tucker Carlson tried to jump on in a recent sort of Bernie-like monologue. So that would indicate to me that maybe there are some fissures on the other side, if you will.
Yeah, I think that so basically I've written that increasingly there's this contradiction between the two wings of the conservative movement, the social and cultural sort of reactionaries, and the business elite that are the number one shareholders in the movement, where it's been coming increasingly difficult to argue that the interests of corporate America are identical to the interests of cultural traditionalists when you have an economy in which capital, private investment, is fleeing the most culturally conservative areas of the country, freeing rural areas, freeing low-density, heavily Christian areas, and concentrating in coastal cities where social liberalism is ascendant, and where you have major brands like Nike, in order to appeal to the millennial generation, explicitly, publicly identifying with Colin Kaepernick and identifying with the left's side in the culture war, that these things make it harder for the average Tucker Carlson viewer to not recognize that there is nothing inherently culturally conservative about unfettered, unregulated market capitalism, that it's actually a creative destructive force that does not preserve a certain way of life or certain racial and gender hierarchies that they're attached to. So I think this is a tension in the party. At the same time, so far, the party has been largely successful in just lying about what their fiscal priorities are and really trying to keep the immigration and the cultural grievance salient enough to prevent those tensions from really mattering electorally. Well, and so far, they've been successful.
Right. But until Republican voters find their tax refunds reduced by the recent giveaway to the rich, maybe that might change a few minds.
It's
we can only hope. I thank you for joining us, Eric Levitt.
Yep, thanks for having me.
And again, I mean, speak with Eric Levitt, who writes for New York Magazine's Daily Intelligencer, where his latest article is Meet the New Bernie Campaign, Same as the Old Bernie Campaign. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back looking into the longstanding and growing scandals within the Catholic Church.
You need it, that's for sure.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Kenneth Briggs, who writes for the National Catholic Reporter. He's a professor at Lafayette College and a former New York Times religion editor, and is the author of Power of Forgiveness and Double Crossed, Uncovering the Catholic Church's Betrayal of American Nuns. Welcome to Background Briefing, Kenneth Briggs.
Thank you.
And ahead of the Pope's Sex Abuse Prevention Summit, it does seem that almost every day a new scandal erupts in the press about the Catholic Church, whether it is a secret Vatican department that deals with the children fathered by priests, whether it is the defrocking of an American cardinal, or a kind of expose in the New York Times of a sort of homosexual network in the hierarchy of the Catholic Church. How does the Pope deal with all this? It does seem at some point or other there's got to be some recognition that there are some fundamental structural problems.
I think the Pope has by and large acknowledged that there are some, if not, it hasn't gotten to the level of saying that there's got to be big structural change, but that something is radically amiss in the within the relationships and the behavior of the Catholic Church at the highest levels. And I think he has acknowledged that. I haven't seen any indication that he has any particular prescription for moving beyond it or in any way solving it exactly, except in certain intermediary steps.
So how much do you think then the expectations that this summit brings in terms of ending this constant sort of drip, drip, drip of scandal, is it likely to disappoint?
I think it will, but it already has been tamped down in a lot of the advanced commentary from people even inside the church, including the Pope, who has been very tempered in his accounting of what he sees as happening. I don't think he's been terribly optimistic. I think he's he hopes something will happen, but I think nobody knows, and I don't think anybody's making any particular claims, and there have been certain direct signals that many of the people at the highest levels doubt very much that this can produce much of anything significant. If anything, they're playing it down.
Well, but it's not that easy to play down the fact that 200 church leaders from around the world are gathering at the Vatican starting on Thursday, and it's going for, 3 days? The first day exploring the bishop's responsibilities to their flock, including their legal responsibility to investigate and prevent abuse. Day two, dedicated to accountability, focusing on church leaders working together along with rank-and-file Catholics to protect children. Day three, focusing on transparency and featuring remarks from a Nigerian religious sister, a German cardinal, and a Mexican journalist. So there's going to be a lot of coverage of this, don't you think, Kenneth?
There's going to be a lot of coverage. There's going to be a lot of attention. I don't think there'll be much result from it, because I think this is a worldwide explosion of enormous proportions that involves the whole authority structure and the differences between practice and preaching in the Catholic Church that goes to a very fundamental level. I think this is the biggest crisis, because it takes place in succeeding episodes that the church has faced in perhaps hundreds of years. And it's not going to be solved by any quick meeting or any easy solution. And I don't think this may provide some steps along the way, but I'm doubtful, and I think a lot of people in the middle of this planning for it are doubtful.
And the other scandal, of course, that's just breaking now is about a secret Vatican department dealing with procedures of how to deal with priests who father children. That is a particularly explosive revelation, don't you think?
It is, but all of these things, including that, have been boiling up for a long time. It's not for anybody who's been kind of within the, or had access to the inner workings of the church. None of these issues is new, but the pressure is almost like a volcanic pressure under the dome, had been building for so long that it's all coming apart. The lid is off, and problems and crises that go back a long time are all bubbling up at the same time, but they all stem from the same fundamental problems having to do with hypocrisy and the attempt to take control of a huge institution by instilling a kind of secrecy about all those problems. And the lid is off now, and I think it just continues to roll on and play out. And I think total control of it is going to be impossible. Partial control or containment or policies or differences in attitudes may be possible over a longer period of time. And I think the realism of that is sinking in among many of the top brass in the church. So I think the upcoming meeting will be somewhat contentious. These things, the anxieties that are rampant, will be exposed to some degree, and then they'll go home. And it will continue in some fashion, but I don't think anybody knows at this point what form any steps toward a new day can be taken at this point. But we'll see.
Well, apparently there's no actual figure on the number of children that have resulted from liaisons or affairs involving priests and laywomen and, or nuns, and, of course, the others that are the results of abuse and rape. The figures are pretty vague on that. Apparently, these victims, if you want, the children are called the children of the ordained. And I guess it gets back to the question of what happened with this tradition of celibacy amongst the Catholic Church that was codified in the 12th century. My understanding that prior to that, it was fairly common for priests to have children.
Well, yes. I mean, a marriage was not forbidden until that time. So half of the church's history, more than half the church's history, priests could marry. And then the that rule was imposed at that point. But liaisons of this kind have been going on, of course, we would assume, forever. And the children have been produced. There was a case some decades ago now of an archbishop who had children and was supporting them by sending part of the diocesan revenues to the mother and all, keeping it all secret. So these things have been, of course, going back centuries. There are just famous, scandalous cases of the Medici and other bishops who had families. And so it isn't new, but it's just part of the same kind of, again, the same tension between the doctrine and the behavior, and the violations and the impossibility of perhaps the possibility of enforcing absolute laws like that. The right. Catholic Church had built its whole structure and its whole order on sexual morality, and it made it so central to everything that when it begins to fall apart or the hypocrisies begin to appear, it makes it almost impossible for that authority to stand because so much is at stake.
Right, but do you think there is a possibility that, whether it'll happen at this summit or not, I doubt it, but that at some point or other there will be a discussion within the church about the impossibility of celibacy itself being maintained within the church? If you go back to the 12th century, the idea is, you know, it happened before, priests were able to marry, celibacy is not working, why not let priests marry? Is that too radical? It seems like a logical step.
Oh, no, that discussion is going on, and it is fairly widespread. There are people, that has been going on for some time now. The debate over that, although it's not acknowledged as readily, it comes up again and again. And it could be changed overnight because it's not a matter of dogma in the church. It's a matter of discipline. And if they decide, if a pope woke up tomorrow morning and decided to end celibacy, he could. And it would be that simple. Not that it will be, but so that's going on, yeah. And they've already allowed certain married Anglican priests to become Catholic priests, and a lot of those Anglicans have been married. So, and they're allowed to stay married. So it's certainly not beyond the realm of possibility, and the Pope has hinted at that himself without making any particular commitments.
Just in closing, then, the recent revelations in the New York Times about a kind of network, if you will, of homosexuals within the hierarchy of the Catholic Church, it was a very strange story to follow. There was both homosexuality and homophobia involved. And how did it strike you? Or is there any way you can explain it to our audience what exactly that those revelations were about?
Well, there are two points there. One is that the Catholic conservative elements have for a long time been trying to point to homosexuality as a cause of child abuse And that has been refuted and, in fact, studied and proved not to be a link. But that's been one part of it. So you've had accusations that if it weren't for gays, you wouldn't have the child abuse dimensions that you have. That's one part of it. And the other part of it is that there are, mostly spokesmen on the right, the Catholic right, who have been very, very, very critical of the leadership of the church as being too gay, and have been very critical of it and have been attacking the church. So that's an inner church squabble that's been going on for quite a while, and this lends credence to at least some of that, even though the Catholic Church is teaching on celibacy, homosexuality, is somewhat confusing by virtue of the fact that they say it's okay to be gay, but not to act on being gay. And so it confuses the mass somewhat. But there is an element in the church that's very much opposed to what it sees as a gay cabal taking charge of the church. So I don't know how that's going to play out, but it's another one of the very serious issues that owes to the same breakdown of authority and hypocrisy.
But just in closing, is there a gay cabal? That was one of the rumors, that there was a kind of cabal that sort of promoted itself throughout the hierarchy.
Well, there certainly is a very strong gay presence. I wouldn't put it in terms of being a cabal. That's the interpretation being placed on it by some critics within the church, mm-hmm. who see it that way and think there are too many gays in the clergy and that they are exerting too much influence, and that's a cause of a lot of trouble. So it's there, and it's been a corrosive factor, but I don't see it as a movement on the part of gays to somehow gang up and take over the church. I think it's much more complex than that, and I think there isn't a conspiracy involved here. Right. So it's a plain fact that large numbers of Catholic clergy are gay, and technically, according to the church's teaching, that would be okay if they remain chaste. But mm-hmm. when they don't, and some have said they don't, then that's another issue.
Sure,
it's huge.
Right, and the right wing, the Stephen Bannon types within the church, the Knights of Malta, etc., and Opus Dei, etc., they're trying to use this these exaggerations of homosexuality as a way to beat up on the Pope, aren't they? Isn't that the strategy?
Sure. Oh, sure. Yeah, the Pope gets his share of. He's being seen as soft on gays, and that provides a wedge for some of the Bannon types to go after him.
Well, Kenneth Briggs, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Well, thank you. Good talking with you.
And again, I've been speaking with Kenneth Briggs, who writes for the National Catholic Reporter and is a professor at Lafayette College and a former New York Times religion editor. And he's the author of Power of Forgiveness and Double Crossed, Uncovering the Catholic Church's Betrayal of American Nuns. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcast. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. We've also made it easier for you to help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate and commercial free by adding a donation button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to make America think again. Bye for now.
A lady dressed in white with a man she loved.